From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's show, a search for six of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust. Daniel Mendelsohn discusses his book, The Lost. It's just out in paperback. He'll tell us about investigating what happened to his great-uncle who stayed in his Ukrainian town after his siblings left and was killed along with his wife and four daughters. Also, The War. The new Ken Burns documentary about World War II premieres this weekend on PBS. TV critic David Biancooley says the epic has a fresh take on the topic, telling the tale from the bottom up with a focus on soldiers in foxholes. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Into the Wild. Sean Penn adapted the best-selling book by Jon Krakauer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. When people are threatened by war or ethnic persecution, which could lead to genocide, they face the terrible dilemma of whether they should flee their homes or stay. Daniel Mendelsohn's book, The Lost, tells the story of his great-uncle, Shmuel, who stayed in his Ukrainian town after his siblings left. Shmuel, his wife, and their four daughters died in the Holocaust. When Shmuel realized what was in store for the Jews, he wrote letters to his relatives in America begging for help in getting out. Mendelsohn found Shmuel's letters in the wallet of Mendelsohn's late grandfather. How Mendelsohn learned the rest of the story is the subject of his book, which is now out in paperback. Mendelsohn is a contributor to the New York Review of Books and the New York Times Book Review. He teaches at Bard College. Mendelsohn spoke to Terry last year when The Lost was first published. He began with the reading from the beginning of the book.
Some time ago, when I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old, it would occasionally happen that I'd walk into a room and certain people would begin to cry. The rooms in which this happened were located, more often than not, in Miami Beach, Florida, and the people on whom I had this strange effect were, like nearly everyone else in Miami Beach in the mid-1960s, old. Like nearly everyone else in Miami Beach at that time, or so it seemed to me then, these old people were Jews, Jews of the sort who were likely to lapse when sharing prized bits of gossip or coming to the long-delayed endings of stories or to the punchlines of jokes into Yiddish, which of course had the effect of rendering the climaxes, the points of these stories and jokes, incomprehensible to those of us who were young. Like many elderly residents of Miami Beach in those days, these people lived in apartments or small houses that seemed, to those who did not live in them, slightly stale, and which were on the whole quiet, except on those evenings when the sound of the Red Skelton or Milton Berle or Lawrence Welk shows blared from the black and white television sets. At certain intervals, however, their stale, quiet apartments would grow noisy with the voices of young children who had flown down for a few weeks in the winter or spring from Long Island or the New Jersey suburbs to see these old Jews, and who would be presented to them, squirming with awkwardness and embarrassment, and forced to kiss their papery, cool cheeks.
That's Daniel Mendelsohn reading from his new book, The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million. At the beginning of the reading, you say that you had family members who cried when you came into the room. Did you ever know why they were crying?
Well, I did. I did know why they were crying. It may not have been clear to me when it first started happening, but it was soon very obvious to me that the reason they were crying was that I bore or was said to have borne this uncanny resemblance to my grandfather's brother, my great-uncle Shmuel, who had been killed in the Holocaust. And so at some moment, you know, in the way that children's consciousnesses become aware of things, I understood what it was and why this was happening. And for a long time, I don't think I made much of it because of the way in which you accept things as part of your family story or family behavior. And it may be crazy to other people, but you accept it. And then, of course, it was much later when I started to be interested in the story of this person and to whom I was supposed to bear this resemblance.
So, you know, Shmuel is your great uncle who stayed behind in Eastern Europe and died in the Holocaust. And did your family talk about Shmuel, why he stayed, how he died? Did they talk about him a lot? Did they speculate much?
My grandfather, to whom I was very close growing up and who was a great, you know, raconteur in a wonderful style and very mesmerizing as a storyteller, told a lot of stories about a lot of things. He grew up in this small, then Austro-Hungarian and subsequently Polish town at the beginning of the 20th century, and he liked to talk about his experiences. The one thing that he didn't like to talk about was his brother. He told me some things about his brother, as long as it didn't have to do with his brother's death and what happened to Shmuel and his family in the Holocaust. And one thing that struck me only much later as an adult was the information. And this my grandfather didn't tell me until toward the end of his life, and it came to me as a great surprise, which was that Shmuel, who was always sort of known as the one who stayed behind, you know, my grandfather was one of 7 siblings, and six of them emigrated, and only Shmuel remained in Poland. And what came as such a surprise was the information, then new to me, that Shmuel had actually come to the United States in 1913 as an 18-year-old young man to sort of explore the possibilities of resettling the family in New York City. And he came alone and stayed with an aunt and uncle, his mother's brother and his family, in New York City on the Lower East Side, and decided he didn't like America and went back to Poland. He didn't think there was any future for him in America. And so he went back in 1914. Then, of course, World War I started, and he was a soldier in the Austro-Hungarian army. And the rest is history. You know, you have to... I think one of the really important and crucial and interesting points about thinking about people who stayed behind is we now know it was, so to speak, a mistake, you know, and we look back and we say, oh, well, you know, didn't they see the writing on the walls or something like that? But, you know, after World War I, he was a prosperous businessman. He had a good life, a nice wife, four children. He was very successful. And it wasn't until really the bitter end, as in the very late 30s, that it became clear that the world was going to change in a very bad way. And so to us, the decision to go back looks suicidal almost. You know, people are always shocked to hear that. But of course, he didn't have the benefit of hindsight as we do. And to him, it looked like the right choice.
Well, you found your grandfather died in 1980, and sometime after he died, you found several letters that your great uncle Shmuel had written to his brother, your grandfather, and they were all asking for help from your grandfather and his family to help get the brother and his family out, to give them money, to provide help, to offer contacts, do something. And reading these letters, which you reprint in the book, it's like finding these artifacts. And I'm going to ask you to read several of the excerpts for us.
Sure. The letters that Shmuel wrote, the first one is dated in January 39, and the last one we know miraculously made it through to New York in December of 39, which is to say after the war started. And here's a letter in which he's very anxious about the world situation and clearly also self-conscious about having to hector his relatives in America. If only the world were open and I had been able to send one child to America or Palestine, it would be easier, since today children cost a great deal to send, particularly girls. Dear God should only grant that the world should be quiet, because now it's absolutely clouded. One lives constantly in terror. Don't be broigus, which is Yiddish for angry. Don't be broigus with me, my dears, because I write to you so many letters in this pessimistic vein. It's no wonder. In life now there are so many opportunities for people to be so evil to each other. I've now written to you so many times, dear Abby.
And later in letters, he starts almost like begging the family, help get me out of here. Would you read some of that?
Yeah, there's a point at which the desperation is quite patent. You should make inquiries. You should write that I'm the only one in your family still in Europe, and that I have training as an auto mechanic, and that I've already been to America from 1912 to 1913. Perhaps that might work. For my part, I'm going to post a letter written in English to Washington, addressed to President Roosevelt, and I'll write that all my siblings and my entire family are in America, and that my parents are even buried there. Perhaps that will work. And consult with my sister-in-law, Mina, and maybe she can give you some advice about this, as I really want to get away from this Gehenna, this hell, with my dear wife and such darling four children. I emphasize here to you that I do not want to leave here without something to live on. Life is the most precious thing of all, as long as you've got a roof over your head and bread in your mouth and all is safe and sound. I'll now close my letter for today and await a swift answer to the whole question and what you have to say about it.
There's one more excerpt I want you to read. And this is in response to a letter Shmuel has gotten from your grandfather.
Dear Abby, I was just about to send this when at that very moment I received your letter. You upbraid my dear wife for not having turned to her brothers and sisters. And so I write to you saying that you're out of your mind. She already wrote to them and never got an answer. What should she do?
Daniel Mendelsohn reading letters from his great-uncle Shmuel, who died in the Holocaust. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2006. We'll hear more about those letters and about Mendelsohn's book, The Lost, after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Daniel Mendelsohn, author of The Lost, A Search for 6 of 6 Million. It's the story of his great-uncle Shmuel, who stayed behind in his Polish, now Ukrainian town after his siblings left for America. Shmuel, his wife, and 4 daughters were killed in the Holocaust.
Do you know why your family in America didn't send him money? Did they not have the money? Was your great-uncle the kind of person who was always asking favors? Were they annoyed with him for that? Did they not understand how dire the situation was for Jews in Eastern Europe?
Well, it's an interesting question because it raises what to me is such a thorny and also interesting and poignant issue, which is, you know, we, of course, have all of Shmuel's letters to my grandfather and his other siblings in New York, but we don't know what they did. There's no way of knowing what they wrote back, so to speak. I mean, except to parse it from internal clues in the letters that Shmuel's writing. And for example, at one point he makes a reference to money that my grandfather did send, so clearly he sent something, but whether they were able to send $5,000, which is an enormous sum of money to ordinary middle-class people in the year 1939, we have no way of knowing except from what Shmuel writes. And it's impossible to tell whether his increasing impatience with the American siblings is a reflection of reality, so to speak. In other words, a reflection of the fact that they weren't helping at all, or was instead the impatience of a doomed man who understands that the world is locking down around him, no matter what the relatives were doing. I mean, we simply don't know. You know, in the book, I mention this. You know, in this letter that my grandfather sent to Shmuel, to which Shmuel angrily refers in the segment that I wrote, you know, my grandfather could have said many things. He could have said, "We have exhausted every legal possibility. We have tried to wire you money. Have you also asked your wife's relatives?" Or he could have said, "Stop bothering us with these endless pestering letters. We've done what we could. Go ask her relatives." You know, it's impossible to tell the tone of the response. But that, to me, was very interesting, and it raised for me an issue that I wanted to really get to the bottom of in the book, which is to try to resuscitate the personalities of these lost people. And that includes my grandfather and many other of those old Jews in Miami Beach that I refer to in the first page of the book, to make the book be about humans with human frailties and human failings and human emotions, and not just these sort of idealized people from the 1940s, which is how I was always forced to see them, you know, just a bunch of faces and photographs and a little epithet here and there. But those letters were so electrifying to me because they suddenly brought out the personalities and the thorny issues involved.
To find the story of what actually happened to your great uncle during the Holocaust and to his wife and 4 daughters, you track down the surviving members of the town he lived in, Bolochov. How many people were in that town? How many people actually survived the Holocaust?
Well, the Jewish population of the town in 1939 was about 3,000. And when the Nazi occupation began, they rounded up the Jews from a lot of smaller towns nearby. So in 1941, there were 6,000 Jews in Bolochov. And of those 6,000, there were 48 survivors in 1944 when the Soviets liberated the town. And of those 48 survivors in 1944, it turned out that 12 were still alive in 2003 when I began my travels all over the world, tracking them down, trying to get them to tell the story.
Did you find all 12?
I did. Well, you know, it was funny because it was like dominoes. You know, once I found one, but I found all the rest because they all know each other. They're all in touch with each other, either by mail or actually email. A lot of them are on email. So I made contact with the first one in February 2002, and he told me then he had heard that I was looking for relatives of the Yeager family in Bolochov, and he called me from Sydney, Australia one night out of the blue. I didn't even know who he was. And he said, well, I heard you're looking for the Yeagers from Bolochov. And he said, if that's true, you should come to Australia. And I said, why? And he said, because there's five Bolochover Jews, survivors, living in Sydney, and you should come talk to us. So I did. I got on a plane with my brother Matt, and we went to Australia. And once we were in Australia, you know, we interviewed them, and that was just amazing and really helped us a lot to get to the personalities of my lost family and what happened to them. And then as we were leaving, they said, oh, have you been to Stockholm? And I said, who's in Stockholm? And they told us. And then when we went to Stockholm, you know, somebody in Stockholm said, oh, you must go to Tel Aviv. And we went to Tel Aviv. So it was, you know, it was like in the old movies when you see somebody's peregrinations around the globe and there's that little arrow that is drawn from country to country.
Right.
And that's what it really was, zigzagging back and forth crazily sometimes. So it was really like following the bouncing ball. And that's what we did. We found them all.
One of the things you learned was that there were basically two different slaughters in which the Germans mm-hmm. killed most of the Jews in mm-hmm. Bolochov. What did you learn about those two events?
Well, there were what we learned, and this was in Australia when we really started to get the full picture, because you have to understand, we didn't know anything. When I started this book, we did not know anything except what was available in, like, you know, a Holocaust encyclopedia, which is very clipped. And we learned it quite typically for a town in this area in eastern Poland. There was an initial, the Nazis came in the summer of 41, and there was an initial Aktion, or mass killing, in the fall of 41. They killed 1,000 people in a mass grave, machine gunned in a mass grave. And that's when one of my Uncle Schmiel's daughters was taken. She just happened to be out on the street that day and got caught in a dragnet and was marched over to this open pit and killed there. And what was interesting is that between 1941 and 1942, the death camps began to run in earnest, and Belzec began to run. And so in the autumn of 1942 was the second Aktion, and that's when most of the Bolochov Jews were killed. There was an Aktion that lasted three days, in which they rounded up 2,500 people, and they kept them in the courtyard of the city hall for a number of days when they killed most of the children. There were 500 people killed, and the remaining 2,000 were marched to the little town train station and put in cattle cars, and they went to Belzec, and that's where most of Bolochov's Jews perished. And at that point, there remained about 1,000 people, and most of them were younger people, and most of my survivors, the people who were helping me, who remembered Schmiel and his family, were among those 1,000 young, healthy people who had been kept for last because they could work in the forced labor businesses. This was an industrial town, and they had a sawmill and a barrel factory, and they were forced to work in them. And those people were eventually liquidated in 1943, except the ones who went into hiding.
Once you found survivors of Bolochov who knew your great uncle and his family, did you ask them if they knew about the responses that your great uncle was getting from the family in America in response to his pleas to help him get out of Balakhov and into the United States?
Yeah, I did ask them. Well, I you know, at that point, of course, everybody was in the same boat. You know, everybody was frantically trying to think of a way out and had been writing to their American relatives. So I did ask them what the situation was, and one of them laughed, you know, when I mentioned to him Schmiel's letters. And this gentleman, whose name is Jack Green, and he's one of the Sydney Balakhovers, was the high school boyfriend of one of Schmiel's daughters. So he's very close to the family. And he sort of just waved a hand dismissively. He said, you know, people were writing letters like maniacs in 1939. He said it was already closed. You couldn't leave. And anyway, there were already in place in Poland, this is before the invasion by Hitler. You have to remember there was an extremely right-wing anti-Semitic government in place in Poland who were already passing very severe, restrictive economic measures against Jews. So these people already were having trouble getting their money out, you know, buying tickets. I mean, even if it had been possible, it was already, as this man said to me, verfallen. It was already hopeless, you know, it was a lost cause. So although they didn't specifically talk about Schmiel's letters, he just dismissed the whole idea. He said nobody at that point could get out, even if they had wanted to.
Daniel Mendelsohn speaking with Terry Gross. His book, The Lost, is now out in paperback. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with author Daniel Mendelsohn about his book, The Lost. It's now out in paperback. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews The War, the new Ken Burns documentary premiering this weekend on PBS. And David Edelstein reviews the film adaptation of the bestseller Into the Wild, directed by Sean Penn. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview with Daniel Mendelsohn, author of The Lost, A Search for Six of 6 Million, which is now out in paperback. It's about investigating the story of his great-uncle Schmiel, who stayed behind in his Polish, now Ukrainian town after his siblings left for America. Schmiel, his wife, and 4 daughters died in the Holocaust. After Mendelssohn's grandfather died, he found letters written to his grandfather by Schmiel, begging to help him bring his family to America. When we left off, Mendelsohn was reading from some of those desperate appeals.
You've said that you've come to think of Europe as a giant cemetery.
Right.
Why?
Well, one of the things that you get from being immersed in the study of the Holocaust in any way as a historian or in my fashion, which was much more personal and narrow, but anything that forces you to travel in Eastern Europe leaves you with the sense of the, I don't know how to say it in any other way but to say the wrongness of Europe as it is today. I mean, you're constantly reminded as you travel in Europe, if you're traveling with an eye to the Holocaust, of the bizarre absence of these many millions of people, and now, 60 years later, many more millions of people who would have been. And you can't get that out of your head, not least because so many of the physical remains of European Jewry, particularly in Eastern Europe, where the devastation was so total, so many of the physical remains, the synagogues, the storefronts with Yiddish lettering still on the bricks, the Jewish cemeteries, the mikvahs, the ritual bath buildings still with Stars of David carved above the lintels, you know, all of these things are still there. They're still there. And to be confronted with that is to just have brought home in the most devastating way both the sense of the recentness of this event, which sounds like a peculiar thing to say, but I mean, you realize it happened recently enough that there's still all the evidence, so to speak, is still there, and nobody has bothered to clean up. You're confronted with that, and so you think Europe today is completely other than it would have been in a way from which it will never recover. You know, my older brother Andrew said the most moving thing to me, and late into my research and traveling, and he said, well, you know, he said, they feel like they're so remote, Uncle Shmuel and his wife and kids, because they died so long ago. He said, but, you know, there's no reason in the 1970s that they would not have been, oh, yeah, you know, the Polish aunt and uncle and cousins that we would have to go see once a year in Poland if the whole history of the 20th century had been different. And that I just found electrifying because it brought home to me the fact that these people ought to have been alive in my lifetime. And of course, they're not. And many millions more are not. And in that sense, I feel like Europe is just a cemetery. And I say this as, you know, a scholar of the classics, a lover of high European culture, a person who believes in European civilization. But I really do feel like it's there's something poisonous and very haunted that I don't think I'll ever get over.
Your mother's mother, your grandmother on your mother's side, is buried in a cemetery in Queens in a section labeled the First Balakhov Sick Benevolent Association. Mm-hmm. What was this association?
Well, a lot of the Jews who emigrated at the turn of the last century to the United States formed community associations so that, say, all the Jews from Balakhov, now living on the Lower East Side, would contribute to a fund. And they would, in a very communal way, they would help the sick people if somebody got ill, because, you know, of course, these were recent immigrants with not a lot of money. They would pool resources, and they would also buy a plot of land in a cemetery and reserve it for people from that town. So even in the new world, even in death, they were all still representing the old shtetl that they came from, and that's what that was.
Well, you know, having been to Balakhov and done so much research there about how your family was killed, what does it mean to you now to see that, the First Balakhov Sick Benevolent Association, in the cemetery?
Well, it's very moving to me because I think of it as a sort of colony, you know. And of course, at the time these places were started up and these cemetery plots were bought in New Jersey and New York, you know, they could have no idea that the mother country, so to speak, would be erased from the face of the earth. And the fact of what subsequently happened during the Holocaust gives, in my mind, a special poignancy to these little outposts of Balakhov and all these other places, of course, in the New World. I think of them. I'm glad they're there, because if they weren't there, there would be no trace of this place anywhere.
Daniel Mendelsohn, author of The Lost, speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with author Daniel Mendelsohn. His book, The Lost, is about investigating the story of his great-uncle, Shmuel, who died in the Holocaust along with his wife and four daughters. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2006.
You know, I can't remember whether it was in your book or in an article I was reading, in which you talk about what went through your mind after first reading about Abu Ghraib and the human pyramid that was formed there of naked Iraqi prisoners.
Right.
Tell us what it made you think about.
Well, one of the pieces of information that I got on my first trip to Bolokhov, when I was just interviewing elderly Ukrainians who had been there during World War II, was that during the first Aksyon, when the 1,000 people were rounded up, they were kept first in a local building and tortured for about a day and a half before they were taken to this mass grave. And one of the things, apparently, that they were forced to do was to, the Germans and the Ukrainian accessories would make the Jews form these pyramids, and they would put the rabbi on the top, human pyramids, and put the rabbi on the top and knock him off and beat him. And so when I read about Abu Ghraib, I had to pause and wonder, what is it that makes people want to do this terrible sort of ritual humiliation of building people into these sort of weird perversions of buildings, you know, because that's what a pyramid is, and then destroying it. It seemed to me to be a kind of metaphor for civilization and destruction right there, that you, this weird mock building up and knocking down. And I was just, because I'd been so electrified by this fact when I first heard it about Bolokhov, when the Abu Ghraib thing happened, of course, it was the first thing I thought of.
And what did it mean to you? What were you thinking of knowing that Americans had done this to Iraqis?
Well, I thought the natural thing that you end up thinking when you study the history of the Holocaust, which is that anybody is capable of anything, and that there is no nation that has claim to moral superiority. I mean, I think that much has been made clear, and that there's some very base, low human impulse toward desecration and torture and violence that exists apparently in everybody. You know, the thing about the Holocaust, especially in little Eastern European towns where neighbors turned about against neighbors, that you keep getting is that otherwise normal-seeming people would, if under the right combination of circumstances, turn into what one of my survivors kept referring to as cannibals, savages. And that certainly ran through my mind, and it continues to run through my mind, and it's the thing that has impressed me most. You don't feel safe anymore after you think about this material because you realize anybody could do anything.
You know, you've pointed out that you think of yourself as the last generation to have come in direct contact with, you know, to have grown up with people of that Holocaust generation of Jews. You're the grandchild of people who survived the Holocaust and of people who were killed in the Holocaust. And after that, as you point out, it's history. People will know of it as history. I don't know what my question is there, but I think we are very aware of a generation dying out.
Well, I was certainly possessed by this notion all through my life, and certainly the writing of my book, which is that, you know, history is specific. It's not general. It's certain people at certain times. And my generation is essentially the last generation in the history of this planet that will have been in a position to talk to know, as a subsequent generation, knowing an older generation, the people who went through the Holocaust. And after us, it's all people who will never have direct personal contact with Holocaust survivors, with people who were there. And the question I keep thinking about, and which I was possessed by as I wrote my book, is what happens to this event then? There will come a time in our lifetime in which the last Holocaust survivor dies. What happens then? How does this event then get transmitted to a subsequent generation to whom it can never be a tangible reality, a memory of what an old man looked like or smelled like or felt like? And that's the thing that I kept thinking of. And I think that we're the hinge. You know, my generation, kids who knew old people in the 1960s and 70s who were Holocaust survivors, are the last generation to have that. And as a person who's a writer, as a person who's a scholar of lost civilizations, I'm very interested in the phenomenon of how a person's or a generation's lived experience becomes the narrative that is transmitted to a subsequent generation. And of course, what my book is trying to do is to, in some sense, be that narrative. And it's very aware of itself as that narrative. And the people who were talking to me knew that they were entrusting to me like a precious little package. And they knew I was going to be the one to give it to many other people when they couldn't anymore. And that was a very moving thing.
Well, Daniel Mendelsohn, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Daniel Mendelsohn speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. His book, The Lost, is now out in paperback. Beginning Sunday, PBS presents the latest documentary epic from filmmaker Ken Burns. It's about World War II and is titled simply The War. It spans 15 hours of primetime television over 2 weeks, but our TV critic David Biancooley promises the investment is worth the time.
The War, the latest documentary epic by Ken Burns and company, requires a lot of commitment if you're going to watch it on PBS the next 2 weeks. It's 15 hours long and spills over so many nights that if you plan to see it all, you pretty much have to plan your week, your weeks, around it. That same type of commitment was required exactly 17 years ago, when Burns presented The Civil War, and it was a huge hit. Then and now, a story of a complicated, lengthy war was itself doing battle with splashy new shows from the fall TV season. The difference between now and then is that in 1990, there were no such things as DVDs. The War is just the sort of show that's perfect for home viewing, watching at your own leisure and schedule. But there are fewer and fewer TV events each year that qualify as events, and The War definitely is one of them. It's not only the best thing Ken Burns has done since the Civil War, it's the best thing he's done, including the Civil War. The structure of the narrative, which got Burns in some trouble when Hispanic groups demanded to be included, focuses on four American cities, Waterbury, Connecticut, Mobile, Alabama, Sacramento, California, and the small town of Luverne, Minnesota. We learn about the war, for the most part, from the points of view of the young men who went overseas to fight and the loved ones who worried about them back home. This approach, as laid out by Burns, co-producer and co-director Lynn Novick, and writer Jeffrey C. Ward, brings three fresh things to the table. One, it lays out the story of World War II in a comprehensive chronological fashion. We follow the ground battles in Europe, but also the sea and air battles in the Pacific. The prisoner of war camps in Manila, the shark-surrounded USS Indianapolis, the firebombing of Dresden, it's all here, mapped out, literally mapped out, in that arrows and colors graphic style that brings to mind newsreels of the 1940s. The second thing this production does freshly is tell its tale from the bottom up, focusing on soldiers in the foxholes rather than generals in the command posts. Strategy is touched upon, but what matters more is what happened during each conflict and how it felt to be there. This effect is amplified because as we follow the soldiers from these four chosen towns, we get to know them very well and care about them a lot. One of them, a quiet fighter pilot named Quentin Annenson, tells his own story, so we know he lives. But thanks to what he reveals in this documentary series, we also know how he thinks. After years of combat, when his optimistic spirit finally gives way, here's a letter he writes home.
I live in a world of death. I have watched my friends die in a variety of violent ways. Sometimes it's just an engine failure on takeoff, resulting in a violent explosion. There's not enough left to bury. Other times, it's the deadly flak that tears into a plane. If the pilot is lucky, the flak kills him. But usually he isn't, and he burns to death as his plane spins in. Fire is the worst. In early September, one of my good friends crashed on the edge of our field. As he was pulled from the burning plane, the skin came off his arms. His face was almost burned away. He was still conscious and trying to talk. You can't imagine the horror. So far, I have done my duty in this war. I have never aborted a mission or failed to dive on a target, no matter how intense the flak. I have lived for my dreams for the future, but like everything else around me, my dreams are dying too. In spite of everything, I may live through this war and return to Baton Rouge. But I am not the same person you said goodbye to on May 3rd. No one could go through this and not change. We are all casualties. In the meantime, we just go on. Some way, somehow, this will all have an ending. Whatever it is, I am ready for it.
He never mailed it. The third and final triumph of the war is the decision to spend so much time on the home front. This is where the war gets some of its most resonant moments, too, and where it finds this documentary's most amazing voice. It sounds like Tom Hanks, because that's who reads the words. But the words were written by a newspaper editor named Al McIntosh, who wrote a regular column for the local paper in Laverne, the Rock County Star-Herald. His personal little essays for that paper, the 1940s equivalent of blogs, really, speak with amazing directness and casualness to readers. Here's what he had to say, for example, on what could have been a very jubilant occasion, the 1945 announcement that the Germans had surrendered. Here's Tom Hanks reading the words of Al McIntosh.
Unlike New Yorkers who whooped, hollered, and tore up tons of paper to throw in the streets, the news here was greeted with quiet dignity and reverent restraint. One by one, the flags blossomed out on Main Street, and store by store, the employees quietly filed out, and the business places were locked up for the day. But there was no shouting, no hilarious display of any kind. Most everybody went home. There was quiet exultation over the fact that a great victory had been achieved. But that rejoicing was tempered by the sobering knowledge that there was another great war yet to be won.
The stories from the various battlefronts are unforgettable. So are the stories told from back home. They combine to make one of the most informative yet quietly emotional documentaries I've ever seen. The War, for any medium, is a masterwork.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, David Edelstein on Sean Penn's film Into the Wild, based on the book by John Krakauer. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The actor Sean Penn has written and directed the new film Into the Wild, based on John Krakauer's 1996 best-selling book. It tells the true story of a young man who hits the road, stripped of his material past, in search of his true being he believes he'll find only in the wilderness. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Humans testing themselves against nature. That's the theme of John Krakauer's nonfiction book Into the Wild and the film adaptation by Sean Penn. The subject, Chris McCandless, is an upper-middle-class college graduate who in 1992 took to the road without telling his family. He gave away most of his money and burned the rest. He adopted the gung-ho pseudonym Alex Supertramp. He wandered the south and northwest and ended up in Alaska, on the edge of the Denali National Forest, the setting for what he called in his journal the climactic battle to kill the false being within. Sadly, he also killed the true being without. His decomposed body was found in a sleeping bag in an abandoned bus. When Krakauer covered the story for Outside Magazine, he got bags of mail from people who said McCandless was a self-destructive nutcase who gave wilderness exploration a bad name. The book was an attempt to refute that, to put the young man's odyssey in a great American tradition of wilderness explorers, some of them nutcases, but others visionaries. Books by Thoreau, John Muir, and Jack London were in McCandless's backpack beside his moldering corpse. In the movie, Penn goes further than Krakauer in affirming his protagonist's heroism. As played by Emil Hirsch, McCandless is a big-hearted, high-spirited youth who needs to break from his over-controlling family and whose only mistake is forgetting to come up with a way out of the wild. Penn brooded on McCandless's story for a decade, and watching the film, you can feel his envy of McCandless's life, and even, in a masochistic way, his death. That passion carries you over some bad ideas, like the original songs by Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder, irony-free odes to leaving big bad society behind. Emil Hirsch has a wide-open face that's instantly readable, even when he sports a full black beard. He seems lofted by optimism. Almost everyone who meets Alex, that's his nom de voyage, remember, wants to adopt him, like Catherine Keener and Brian Dierker, as a pair of hippie nomads.
So you're a leather now.
I'm a leather?
Yeah, a leather tramp. That's what they call the ones that hoof it. On foot. Technically, we're rubber tramps.
Because we have a vehicle.
Yeah, Alex could have a vehicle as well, but he decided to burn all of his money. And why did you do that?
I don't need money. It makes people cautious.
Come on, Alex. Got to be a little cautious. I mean, that book of yours is cool and everything, but can't depend entirely on leaves and berries.
I don't know if you want to depend on much more than that.
Where are your mom and dad?
Living their lives somewhere.
You look like a loved kid. Be fair.
Fair?
You know what I mean.
Hirsch's McCandless is a little manic, but he's otherwise romanticized, which makes him blander than in Krakauer's book, where people say he was often angry and aloof. One critic I read said the movie is good even though the protagonist is a cipher. I don't think he's quite a cipher, but if I did, I'd have a hard time calling the movie good. As a director, Penn has a lot of restless energy. He leaps around in time. He serves up fancy montages, lyrical slow motion, and narration by several different characters, among them McCandless's sister, played by Jenna Malone. There are long excerpts from McCandless's letters and journals, with an occasional bon mot plucked out and scrawled across the screen. Alex flees civilization to learn to be in the moment, but the movie is so busy it has no present tense. It's at war with its own message. After all the nits are picked, though, there are scenes in Into the Wild that stay with you. Kristen Stewart plays a leggy 16-year-old in a vagabond flea market with a whopping crush on McCandless. Her longing for him and the liberation he represents is incredibly vivid. Hal Holbrook plays an old man who lost his family to a drunk driver and withdrew into himself. His scenes aren't well staged, but his craggy simplicity inspires Penn to slow down. The final Alaska sequences, in which Chris makes a mess of butchering a moose and loses the meat to maggots, have a shock value beyond the yucky imagery. It's his first inkling of his vulnerability, his first real lesson from the natural world. It would have made a great story in the book McCandless didn't live to write.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeldt. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from PBS, presenting an epic new series on World War II from director Ken Burns, The War, Sunday night at 8, 7 Central on PBS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Kayville, we meet Anthony Anderson, who stars as a detective on the new Fox TV drama set in post-Katrina New Orleans. Also stand-up comedian and Daily Show contributor Dimitri Martin. He's got a new DVD called Person. Join us for the next Fresh Air.